Italian Wine Podcast. Cin Cin with Italian Wine People.
Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast with a twist today because we're going to be talking about sake. We're going to be talking to Marco Massarotto, whose company is called La Via del Sake, which is the sake road, I guess, right?
The way of sake is okay, a Japanese concept.
Okay, so how did you get into... Where are you from in Italy, first of all, and how did you get into sake, and why have you become such a fanatic for sake, and why do you want to spread the word?
Well, I'm originally from Veneto, so close to here, half from Venezia and Bassano de Grappa, but mostly I'm from Milano, where I live and work. And during my business trips to Japan, thanks to Melinda Jo, which is a very famous sake journalist based in Tokyo, I went to a food tasting and found myself in front of a wooden barrel with square wooden glasses with no idea what was inside. My idea of sake at the time was, like most of the people, that sake is a hot liquor you drink for digestion, which is almost all wrong. And when I saw this, given my Veneto roots, I just drank without asking. So I took this square cup and had a sip. And then I asked Melinda, what is this? It's so good. It's so fresh, floral, fruity. And she told me, it's sake. And I was like, oh, but sake is a hot liquor. So I had I've been frowned by her. And so we discuss all nights the misconception about sake, how little people know about sake. And imagine that in Milano, the first cuisine eaten by the people after the Italian cuisine is Japanese cuisine. And we are the land of wine. So
in Milan, which is Italy's almost industrial or business capital.
Yeah, 600 or 700 Japanese restaurants.
Really?
Yeah. All are run by Japanese, but they are Japanese food. And the people doesn't understand the difference. So what happens, usually what happened, because now it's getting better, is that Italian people were going to dinner at a Japanese restaurant and speaking to a Chinese owner and asking a hot sake after dinner. Nobody knew anything about that, so they convinced each other that that was the way to drink it. I mean, we can drink hot sake in some conditions, but it's not a liquor, it's not a distill, it's a fermented product.
So what is it? What is it made from?
It's made from rice. So just to finish that, the story short, after that, I decided to start my association to share this story, the story of the product, the story of the trade, the story of the craftsmen and the makers. And the sake is made by rice. It's a fermented beverage made with fermented rice. It's a process midway between beer and wine, and it finishes with 14-15 degrees. So it's by every mean a product that should stand in the shelf of beer and wine.
So 15% alcohol.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to dilute it or not? Is that considered very bad etiquette?
You mean as a producer or as a drinker?
No, as a drinker.
No. Diluted with water?
Yeah.
No. Would you dilute wine?
No.
No, so same thing.
Okay. So you made your first trip to Japan when?
About 10 years ago.
Do you speak Japanese?
I'm studying now. Well, I started with a business trip as a Western person for a car maker. So, not even food related. And I've always been fond of Japanese culture. So I decided to come back after that. And then the La Via de Sake slipped out of my hands because I started getting invitations. I've been awarded by the Japanese Sake Association as a Sake Samurai, which is a funny name for the Western, but it's a very important recognition for them. And so now I ended up married to a Japanese woman with an Italian-Japanese son, with a business going up and down. So I go now very often. But it all started with a glass, basically.
Well, it's great that you got there through taste.
Yeah,
isn't it? It wasn't about the history or the even the culture. It's actually something that you tasted, that you loved, that you found interesting, and that you've really followed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So overall, we talked about Milan. What about the sake scenario in Italy at the moment? Is it growing? Where is it growing, and why is it growing?
It is growing. It is growing. The sake export is growing. It's very small compared to the national sake production. It's 2-3%. So that is a critical number. Critical because sake decline in the consumption internally as wine did in Italy because of a lifestyle change.
In Japan, you're talking about?
Yeah. In Japan, the sake internal consumption declined. And so the numbers of producers declined. And since the export rate is so small, it's a critical issue because it's a survival issue. So sake needs to be internationalized as a production to be produced elsewhere and as a consumption, first of all. And so it's growing everywhere. It's growing in Italy. After the export 2015, it's grown very much. Now Italy is the second market in Europe.
So who drinks it there? Is it it young, trendy people that want? Are they going to move on to the next fashion, or is it older connoisseurs, if you like, that are prepared to try new stuff?
If I should say who drinks it and who likes it, it's a little bit of all the ones you said. The main distribution channel that leveraged the growth of sake in the past 5 years has been Japanese restaurants, which started putting a quality sake selection in their list and selling it. And now the next step for sake is making its way into the wine world, into the wine and beers world. So wineries, restaurants, sommeliers, and wine experts who wants to widen their list or their shelf to have one more option to pair with food, which is also the best way to enjoy sake.
Okay, we'll come on to the food in a moment. Sure. So for the first time this year, Vinitaly International, which has a blind wine tasting competition called Cinque Stelle or Five Star, for the first time there was a sake category and you were in charge of that.
Yeah.
If I was on your panel, what would you say to me before I start tasting? Would you tell me the things to look for in a sake? What should a good sake have in terms of flavor or texture?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Stevie for this opportunity.
Stevie Kim, who's Managing Director of Vinitaly International.
For this opportunity for sake, which was very important. We had a great interest from so many important people in the wine world. It was a real challenge also because this was very quick to set up and we had to fit sake into the wine
the
criteria
somehow
for technical reasons for this first year, but which was fine because we are in Italy, we are in Europe, so we want to make the product appreciated by those standards. So what we had to do was a small panel, just 3 people, but what we had to do is we judged the sake visually by the nose and by the palate, which we do all the time, but we didn't do a proper sake form tasting, which there are. WCT is a great level 3 SAT form for tasting sake.
That's the Wine and Spirit Education Trust.
And what we did was creating profiles of sake, and we divided them by category, and we explained to the table what is the profile of that sake. So this sake is almost all the times colorless and water white. So if you have it crystal clear, it's fine. If you have some notes, it might depend on that. So if you find a consistent some color notes, it might depend on some fermentation styles. So we explained the profile, and so the judges were able to understand that that color was deriving from a natural fermentation style, which you find at the palate, and so that made sense. Or that color was poor conservation, and as a matter of fact, we had a bad palate experience, which never happened, luckily. But this was the concept. So if you were there, would have lectured you a little bit about the profiles of sake. We hope we can do next year.
So you know, there's this thing about making these orange wines, these white wines that have skin contact, made like red wines. Is that happening with the rice wines as well, the sake wines as well? Is that when you said about the color? You said some wines had a color from...
No, the color might... Well, we tend to think the sake is colorless, but I would say the 40% of the sake, or even more, has a light color or some colors.
Well, light yellow, light green?
It's a light lemon green, pale lemon green, and then it gets up to gold and amber for the aged sake.
How long do they take? A sake that's made to age, how long does it take to develop its color? Because obviously wine changes color.
I'm sorry if I answer, it depends, but it's the typical answer for sake. It depends, because the sake aged 5 to 10 years at -5 degrees temperature, which don't evolve in color. They're completely colorless, but it tastes like dried fruit.
So the flavor changes rather than the color.
Yeah, exactly. Usually you call it koshu, which means aged sake, after 2 years in the tank. The first 1 year in the tank, 6 months to 1 year, is called maturation. It's a standard phase of the production. If it stays in the tank 2 or more years, there's no rules for that, but they usually start calling it koshu. And after 3 to 5 years, it starts evolving in color, and then it gets to amazing colors and amazing flavors. We had at the Milano Sake Festival a tasting of the vertical 5, 10, 20, 30 years old sake, which was really unbelievable. But color, just to finish quickly, might depend on the fermentation style. So if you make a natural lactic acid fermentation, or if you make a low rice polishing ratio, so you keep the rice almost integral and unpolished, that would affect in an important way the color of sake.
The husk around the rice, is that what you're talking about?
The husk gets removed in any case, but then you might ferment sake, so that brings the rice grain to around 90%, what they call semi-bui polishing ratio. 90% is what is left. You took away just that external 10%. If you brew sake with that type of rice, so unpolished, let's say, you would have a sake that might easily turn to a yellow color or a gold color, very rich in umami, what they call the Japanese, because they have lots of proteins that get converted into amino acids. But if you polish the sake and they manage to polish down to 1%, 1% or up to 1%, but it means a small 1% ball of starch, nothing else. Then you have a completely different fermentation, very slow, very cold, and very fruity, because the yeast gets in a survival limit condition, so it starts developing different alcohols and esters. So we're getting really technical now.
Well, it's fun. I mean, what you're saying, I mean, if we didn't know what we were talking about, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about in this interview, but you do. But the last little bit, I think, well, that he's talking about wine, this guy. He's saying all the language of wine you're coming out with.
Well, I can say those things in Japanese, and it wouldn't sound so familiar, but as I told you at the beginning, the fermentation process of sake is a midway between wine and beer. Why midway between wine and beer? Just for the reason that in wine, we ferment fruit. In the sake, we ferment the cereal, rice, like in beer. And the difference with beer is that barley malts naturally because of the germ. Well, in sake, the germ is removed, so the saccharification, the sugar, comes from parallel fermentation done by a mold called koji, Aspergillus oryzae, which eats the starch and transforms into sugar. And this happens in the tank
When you say a mold, you talk about, is it a fungi?
A fungus, yeah.
So rather than a yeast, in wine we have the yeast?
No. In sake, we have the yeast, but the yeast eats sugar and transforms into alcohol.
So it's the fungi that creates
sugar from starch.
And then the yeast ferment that?
It's that sugar and transforms into alcohol. So it's a chain. So and it's called multiple parallel fermentation. So it's probably...
It's called multiple?
Multiple parallel fermentation, the sake fermentation. It's probably the most complex fermentation in alcoholic beverage.
I was just about to say, that sounds extraordinary.
It's done by the Japanese, so no surprise, you know? And they can handle precision. It's very complex because you have to handle the fungus, the koji, not going too fast in producing sugar and not going too slow. If everything goes very fast, or it depends on the fermentation style you want to have. So the sake that you want, everything to rush, the rice to melt, lots of sugar to be produced, and the close the fermentation in 2 or 3 weeks' time, and because you just want to save and make a table product or a carton product.
So in wine, we have obviously, you know, you could broadly say there are three styles of producers. There are the huge multinational behemoths who just churn it out. You have the tiny artisans with small hectares, mainly making for local consumption, either in their family or the local village or town. And then you have kind of pretty much everybody else. Is that the same with sake? Is it something that you can make at home?
Yes and yes. But you find in sake producers, there are 1,350 now. They used to be 30,000 in the 70s. They're only Japan, except very few exceptions in a few countries. But as I told you before, 97% of the production is for internal consumption. So the old cosmos or world of wine, you find it in a microcosmos in Japan with half of the production handled by 5 big producers. And then you have very small brewers for local consumption. And in the middle, you have crafts or artisan or artists or producers that make exceptional quality sake. You can brew it at home, yes. And they used to do it a lot until it got prohibited by the law at some time, just to protect and develop the market. The homebrew sake, unfiltered, very cloudy, it's called Dobroku. And there's a Dobroku festival in Iwate Prefecture, which is lots of fun. It's very uncommon by now, but it could be one of the ways sake internationalizes people, like the beer homebrewers, that could be the sake homebrewers. I don't see that coming yet, but you know, you never know.
So what's the demographic of the people that make it, these artisans? Are they like young 18-year-olds that are full of the joys of sake, or are they grizzled old men and women that are making sake like their grandparents used to make?
It's family-based business, and it's very generational. So, as often happens in Japan, in industries and in companies, you have the shacho, the owner of the company, the president, that is running it until his son is mature enough to handle the business and until he's tired enough to just pass in like an old wise position. Many breweries now have been taken over by 30, 40s younger generation. It's always been like that. So every 30, 40 years, there's a generation change, and every generation change brings a change. So this change will probably... Internationalization sometimes started from the previous generation of ours, so the people that are 60. Others are doing it now. But also the product might change because most of the breweries now produce what is called futsushu, which is table sake, which is less appreciated by younger generations.
So, why?
Well, because
is it more rustic or is it less pure tasting?
It's very ricey tasting, very simple, not complex, not fruity, not delicate. So it's a table sake our grandfathers used to drink. Well, I like it, I must say. Sometimes I go to convenience stores in Japan and had an hamburger and futsushu, and it's great. And it's much better than table wine somehow, because the sake is very simple, it's not low acidity, low fruitiness. So you can make a decent or good product making a basic product, which is more difficult for wine. But let's say less competitive product in modern markets. So the new generation tend to evolve to premium sake.
So what is the etiquette when you drink sake? Do you just knock it back in one, or do you smell it or sip it very slowly? How does it work?
There's a lot of options about the vessels you can drink it in, but basically you drink it like wine. You don't drink it all, not even when it's in the small cups, the ochoko. It's in the small cups because you want to drink a little bit, and so you sip it a little by little. The Japanese, well, it depends where you are, of course, but you don't do toasts or shots because you don't do it with wine. It doesn't make any sense. So you drink it, you make the kampai. The kampai is interesting because it's a cheers where you
click the glasses.
Clink the glasses, but they have a completely different attitude in Japan. So usually we raise our glasses. In Japan, you, as a sign of respect for your person at the table with you, you try to go a little bit below with your glass to the other one, and trying to make the person feel more important on the table. So it's an opposite game to our rising glasses.
But it's not like just a man thing. This is male, female, men, women drink as well, or is it more of a man thing?
No. It's drank by all generation. Then traditional, very traditional contests might have the woman serving sake at the table, but that would be really, really traditional contests that are disappearing quickly. Now the women are emancipating very, very fast in Japan, and the new governor of Tokyo for the first time is a woman politician, so that's really old style.
So you think sake could have a an effect on the social order as well, in terms of being one way where, I didn't know this, when women get more, I'm not saying equality, but is that right?
Well, sake is still very traditional,
when you say traditional, you mean very male?
Traditional, I mean heritage of Japanese traditional culture. So it might be bringing innovation because of renewals, but it might also bring very traditional scheme regarding to gender equality. So it's not difficult to find in sake the image of woman pouring. So that might be read as an old-style traditional image, but at the same time, it's an icon of Japanese aesthetics. So it's very difficult to judge when it comes to Japan for these things. And finally, tasting is more and more evolving with the food matching. We're speaking a little bit before, there's a Japanese proverb which says "Nihonshu wa ryori o erabanai," means the sake, Nihonshu, Japanese sake, never fights with food. And it's so true. The low acidity, the non-existence of tannins, and the absence of what we call the fruit in wine makes the sake hidden. You know, there's another Japanese proverb or concept that it says that the Japanese beauty is a hidden beauty. You have to look for it and uncover it somehow.
So you're saying it's a drink with a very subtle flavor.
It's a very subtle flavor. You have to look for it. So if we drink side by side a glass of sake and a glass of wine, well, sake has a little hard time because, you know, wine is shiny in gold color and maybe it's sparkling and intense. But when you drink it with food, sake is really surprising. It's a very different journey. So the wine interacts with food by contrast, with acidity, with tannins, and it's a contrast-fight enrichment of different flavors. Sake works as collaboration, but if you think it's rice, the relation of rice with food. And so sake cleans the sharp aromas of food, so it's great with truffle, it's amazing with cheese. I never think of this as a competition, but I rediscovered cheese and our Italian cheese tradition thanks to sake. And the only absolute judgment I would feel to say is that probably sake is the best thing you can drink with cheese.
Final question, what is the typical level of an everyday sake? To wine, we're talking anywhere between 7% and 15% for a normal wine.
Level, you mean alcohol?
Yeah.
Well, sake goes from 12 to 16, 17. 12 and 16, 17 are extreme. So 12% sake is too light sake, and the 17 is very rare. So usually you have 13, 14, or 15 degrees. It's hard to tell the difference because it's hard to feel the alcohol in sake when you drink it compared to wine because of its hidden nature and subtle nature. And so the average would be 13 to 15 degrees, that would be most of the sake you would drink it.
Marco Massarotto, absolutely fascinating. I know not the first thing, or I didn't until half an hour ago, know the first thing about
it's
sake.
It's a whole world to discover. So
The similarities between sake and wine and the clear differences between the two. So I think next year for the 5-star tasting, I might have to switch and come on your
table.
You're
very welcome to join us. We'd be very happy.
And you're beautifully robed as well. What is the robe you're wearing?
This is called the Happy.
So it's a blue robe with Japanese symbols on the...
The Japanese symbol, this is the ideogram of sake, and this is the ideogram of do.
Like an ideogram?
Ideogram. The kanji or the ideograms of sake. And this is the ideogram of do, which means the way, like the aikido, judo. It's a Zen concept in Japan. The do means the way where you keep learning and you never stop. So this is the Happy, which is the traditional jacket. If you go to the stands of sake, you see all the producers have it. The producers wear. This is a particularly... It's a simple cloth, a simple dress. This is a particularly well-crafted one. I asked the Masumi Brewery, which have an amazing artisan that makes this happy for them, to recommend me for having him produce a few for us. And so I bring it at the events because it catches the eye and it helps starting the conversation.
Yeah, it does. It does catch the eye. And the conversation with you has been really interesting. I feel like I've just scratched the surface of a whole new world in terms of...
perfect definition. It's exactly that. That's what happened to me when I had this 2 hours conversation with Melinda in Tokyo 10 years ago. And then I said, we have to tell this story to the Italian people, but to the European people, because it's amazing. It's full of interesting things, and it's completely unknown, and it's part of a culture which we know very well. So there's a lot to say. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having sake.
Marco Massarotto, thanks very much for coming on the Sake Wine Podcast today.
My pleasure.
It'd be good to do some recording on the road, in Japan. Thanks a lot, Marco.
Thank you.
Follow Italian Wine Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.